For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Yeah, it's really wonderful to see so many come out to learn together. I hope that what I share with you tonight will be something that is pertinent and meaningful, and meaningful to all, even though we have such varied backgrounds and probably varied levels of previous learning. Nevertheless, I hope that we'll be blessed to share ideas that, as I said, are meaningful to all, from the ones who are most learned or least or whatever it may be. And so along that line, definitely if I say something that you have no idea what I meant, you don't like have no idea what he's talking about, then please ask me about it. And given the size of the crowd, if you have a very specific personal kind of question, then I'm not running away after, and we can deal with it after with God's help. Let me tell you a little bit about what inspired me to give this series, and a very important housekeeping thing. We are meeting this week in Yirtzeh Hashem and next week with God's help, but then there's a 2-week break. So this is a series of 4 classes that will meet on the 7th and 14th of February and the 7th and 14th of March. I will be out of town on the 21st. There is another community event on the 28th. And so we're going to meet now. And even though momentum is the teacher's best friend, okay, we're going to hope that there'll be enough momentum to come back after a 2-week break. So what inspires me to give this class is that I didn't look up the definitions of these two words. I had meant to, but I think we all know that there's a difference between simple and simplistic. Okay, simple can be defined as something uncomplicated. You know, I know what to do. It's the instructions are clear. Simplistic could possibly be defined as something that is not well articulated, even though it is somewhat complicated. So it's a complicated concept, and yet it's not well articulated and not well thought through. And I think it was the writer Emerson, I think it was Emerson, who wrote that for the simplicity on this side of complexity, I wouldn't give a fig. But for the simplicity on the other side of complexity, I would give my life. That's a very big idea. That means that sometimes you're in a fight. You don't get along with somebody. And somebody who has no idea what the issues are says to you, you should just call her. You have no idea what the issues are. You should just call her. You have no idea. But the person says, you should just call her. Now, that is the simplicity on this side of complexity. And it's basically worthless because it doesn't motivate me and doesn't give me strength to do something. And yet, what we all really yearn for is the simplicity on the other side of complexity, where after it's all said and done, we've worked it out and we talked about it, you know what the bottom line is? You should just call her. And when you come to that, you should just call her in relationships, in business, in your efforts to be the best you can be, in whatever is meaningful to you, that is so delicious to have the simplicity after the complexity. Simplicity before the complexity is just distracting. It's not just distracting. It's disrespectful to the situation. But after, what we yearn for is the what? Okay, now in bite sizes, what should I do? How should I handle this? And so, the truth is that I think that a lot of Torah messages are not simplistic. They are potentially simple in the expression in our own lives, but they're not simplistic. And so I have found that especially in Hasidic writing, I have found that there are several themes, probably many. I think there's a book to be written on this topic, of what I consider complementary opposites. Complementary opposites are things that push in opposite directions. They push in opposite directions, and yet they are both strong positive values, and we have to figure out how do we come to the behavioral choices we'll make after we have considered both sides. And so, for example, a topic we're not going to talk about tonight is I the individual, I the community member. Those are opposites. Those are tell me to concern myself for others, and it tells me to concern myself for myself. Everyone here knows that both are true. Everyone knows that those are accurate. Everyone knows that in the Torah there are messages of accuracy to both. And so in a future class we're gonna talk about that, how these two things come together. Now, another example, which I think we're going to talk about in a future class, is humility and confidence. Now, there's so many words in English that you could choose to describe what is described in some Hebrew words as gaiva or geus. You could use the word arrogance. You could use the word boastfulness. Those are probably bad, plain and simple. But believing that you can do it and you have talents is a good thing. Believing that you're the only person on the face of the earth who has those talents is a lie. It's incorrect. Okay? So believing that this is your moment, that the world, God has sent you this moment, and it's your responsibility, is true. Believing that every moment is your moment, it's not true. So those are examples, humility, which is a value, and confidence, knowledge of you know, self-worth, they are complementary opposites. Me as the member of the community, me as the individual watching out for myself, complementary opposites. So tonight, we're going to talk about two huge concepts, and it's not going to be comprehensive. You know, you can spend your whole life talking about these concepts. And the concepts that we're going to talk about tonight are the two Hebrew words, ahava, which means love, and yira, which means fear, but can also mean reverence, a sense of awe. And we'll go on a little journey. Please, if you have questions, then feel free, especially if it's something that I said it doesn't make any sense at all. So interrupt and tell me I didn't get that. A departure point is going to be a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Okay, in Pirkei Avot, the Mishnah says, third Mishnah, Antignos ish socho kibel mishimon hatzadik. The second generation of individual leaders of the Jewish people as far as Torah scholarship was this man, Antignos ish socho, and he received the tradition from Shimon hatzadik. Huhaya omer, Antignos used to say, Al tiyucha avarim hamishamshin es harav almanas lekabel pras. By the way, don't be intimidated by the Hebrew. I promise I'll translate everything. Okay, so if I say something in Hebrew, just don't worry about it. It's not Greek, and it's guaranteed to be translated. I'm certain. And if I don't, then tell me you didn't translate that. Do not be like servants who serve the master on the condition of receiving reward. Ella havu kavadam hamishamshin esarav shalom anas lekabel pras. Rather be like servants who serve the master, not for the condition or purpose of receiving reward. Last four words, v'hi mora shamayim aleichem, and let the fear of heaven be upon you. In these three clauses, don't be like the servant who serves for the purpose of reward. Rather be like the servant who serves, not on the condition to receive reward. And the fear of heaven shall be upon you. In these three clauses, this great leader of the Jewish world from several thousand years ago, 2,000 years ago, is telling us the whole picture of what God asks from us in our relationship with him. But the truth is that it's also it is illustrative for the purpose of all relationships. Because all relationships are governed by love and affection on the one hand, closeness, a desire to be close. And on the other hand, what you could even really, nobody likes this word, but you can use the word fear, reverence, respect. In fact, parents often say to their children, Torah says you should honor your parents when the child is being disrespectful. Okay, now a child's being disrespectful, that is the presence of a negative behavior by a child to a parent. That shows a lack of respect and a lack of reverence and fear. It hasn't actually arrived at a child doing anything for the parent, which would be a expression of love, an expression of care and concern and demonstration of feelings. If I have a relationship with my boss, then I can illustrate bad behaviors that make a question, should we keep this guy around? But even if I show no bad behaviors, so I'm showing respect and I'm not acting inappropriately, I'm not insubordinate or whatever it may be, I may not have demonstrated at all any behaviors that show my commitment to the cause, my work ethic, the things I want to do to make good things happen. So on the one hand, there is the absence of bad behaviors. On the other hand, there ought to be the presence of positive behaviors. Now, if I have the presence of positive behaviors, so I'm the world's best husband as it relates to doing things for my wife. I buy all the right presents. I share the burdens of whatever the she'd like me to demonstrate that I share the burdens for. I provide for her whatever. I provide love and affection, closeness. But I have all kinds of bad behaviors. So, God forbid, for example, I provide those same kind of love and affection to somebody else. Total disaster. Total disaster. There is no amount of acting the good stuff that could possibly be enough to cover up doing bad stuff. Right? So relationships are governed by simple. Now here's the simplicity after the complexity. Relationships are governed by doing good and not doing bad. Simple idea. Doing good and not doing bad. Right? That's a pretty simple concept. Of course, it's more complicated than that. Right? But that's the simple reality. Now, if we go back to the Mishnah that we started with, the opening statement here says, do not be like a servant who serves the master to receive reward. Rather be like a servant who serves the master so as not to receive reward. I'm not in that condition. It could be understood from this statement, that there's no reward in punishment. There is no reward. Serve and there will be no reward. Now, heavy topic. Just let's put it in brackets. You can forget I said it for tonight. Okay, that the Jewish religion believes in reward and punishment. This world, the next world, whatever it may be. So let's not get lost and think that there isn't. But the first message is, don't be the one who serves because there is reward and punishment. Actually, the commentaries here, I believe it's the Rambam, describes that there were two students who left this message before the last line. They only heard the first part. And they went off and became heretics. They became famous heretics. Tzadok, who became the head of the Tzedukim, and Baisus, who became the head of the Baisusim, basically major groups of heretics in Jewish history, because they walked away saying, there's no reward in punishment, that's it. In other words, how I behave is inconsequential. It's inconsequential, that's what I heard. To that, there's four more words. V'yihi me'or ha'shamayim aleichem. Let the fear of heaven be upon you, meaning that it is consequential. How we behave is consequential. So, I want to describe what it means to serve, not for the receiving of reward, which is an act of love. Really what this mission is saying is, it's better to serve out of love than out of fear. It doesn't mean that one should not be fearful, and we'll explain this idea of fear, hopefully, with God's help. But let's talk about what it means to serve out of love. Does anyone here have a favorite author, but like really a favorite author, like somebody you'd like to meet, you'd like to have lunch with? Yeah, anybody want to reveal who your favorite author is? Feel comfortable?
Daniel Silver.
Daniel Silver. Is that Daniel or Danielle?
Daniel.
Daniel Mayle. Okay. So it's a good example. I have no idea who that is. Maybe I'm an ignoramus, but I have no idea who that is. Okay. So is Daniel Silver living?
Yes.
Okay. Would you like to meet him? Like to have lunch?
Yes.
So if I told you that Daniel Silver is arriving tomorrow on the British Airways flight from London to Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport and needs a ride, okay, and I can't find him a ride, you'd be happy to drive him? you'd be happy to drive him. Okay, good. Now, so I call you up, I say, hi, Irma, it's Ariel Shoshan, Daniel Silver's coming in tomorrow, and he needs a ride. And you say, no problem, I got it. Yeah? Okay, now you know that giving people rides from the airport is something that people get paid for. Uber, Lyft, taxis, right? And private drivers. So why don't you respond to me when I say he needs a ride? Why don't you respond to me, what's the pay?
Pleasure. You just want to meet him.
You want to meet him. So I don't have to pay you. Would you take money if I did pay you? Is he a very rich man?
I have no idea.
Okay, oh, yeah,
probably.
Yeah.
Would you take money if he paid you?
No.
Okay. I might. Why not? Why not? All right. So you want to because essentially you love him. In other words, there's an element of affection for this moment that I want to be connected to that. Some of you have heard me tell the story before that I had a friend when I was a child who had all kinds of opportunities in the sports world because his father's friend was a well-known sports writer in the Chicago news media. And so my friend was sometimes the bat boy for visiting teams at Wrigley Field for the Cubs. He was sometimes the ball boy for the Bulls. Okay, the Bulls had a very famous player back then. You know, and he passed the ball to Michael Jordan. And I often thought about many times, I mean dozens, maybe hundreds of times since then in my adult life, I thought, when he got the call, hey, Jonathan, we need somebody to come down and be the bat boy tomorrow or the ball boy. Did he respond at the age of 10, 11, 12, whatever? Did he respond and say, what's the pay? He didn't respond, what's the pay, because he sensed that this is something I want to be connected to. And we all have that in our lives. We have it. Authors, athletes, musicians, Torah scholars. We have it for family members. So that's what it means to serve out of love. And so why should somebody serve Hashem out of love, perform a mitzvah out of love? Very simple. If you like authors, they have a creator. But they don't just have a creator. Authorship as a notion has a creator. Literature as a notion has a creator. The human eye has a creator. Jumping ability has a creator. History has a creator. You have a creator. Kenanara, your children have a creator. One should be, theoretically, propelled into the desire to be connected to something that God is welcoming me into, a bond. Now, one of these things that's very personal for me is that not everybody likes to perform every mitzvah. Some people do like to perform certain mitzvahs. Others are a drag. Let's be honest. It's hard sometimes. I have not yet met the person who says, can't wait, Pesach is coming. Can't wait. Pesach is coming. I'm all in. It's exciting. I'm going to clean the whole house. It's great. Right? Nobody says that. So for me, I have a lot of personal pleasure in putting on my tefillin every day. There's a lot wrapped up in that. I have a sort of advanced sense of what's going on there, to bind to my arm, next to my heart, and onto my head the messages of God's existence and the chosenness of the Jewish people and the historic relationship of care that God shows us. This simply to take, I don't know how many times God's name appears in the Tefillin, but however many times that is, just in order to take God's name and place it on my heart, next to my heart, and on my head. For me, I would do that every day, I think. I think I would do that every day, even if there was no reward. Okay? And it might sound totally foreign to every one of you. To every one of you. I don't need to be paid to go into the sukkah and eat with my family in the sukkah. I would do that, like, without reward. That works for me. Not everything's like that. And you have that too. Everybody has something for you, no matter your religious level. You have something that for you, you want to do the right thing. By the way, it's a right thing. It's a mitzvah to care for your children. To see to someone else's health and well-being is a mitzvah. Most people would do it without the promise of reward for doing it, because I want to. That's meaningful to me. Now, I'm not always present to that. Don't get me wrong. It's not like every single day I come in here like dancing out of my mind that I'm about to put on my tefillin. Okay? It's not that way. I wish it were that way. It's not that way. But that's a very lofty thing to be, if you can imagine it. It's said about, I think it was Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, that he couldn't sleep on the night after the holidays. In other words, when Simchas Torah ends, he stayed up all night the night after Simchas Torah, because for the previous 9 days he hadn't put on his tefillin, and the excitement to put on his tefillin the next morning kept him up all night. Okay, so that's pretty cool. You can imagine that. Sounds scary, lofty, like distant from where I'm holding personal, but we can get it. We can imagine that if we were present to just how spectacular God is, we would want to connect to his instructions. We'd want to connect to his paths of instruction or his intelligence. So we'd want to study Torah instead of listening to the politics or listening to the sports or the music. We would want to, if we were present. Now, here's a very important point. I wasn't going to talk about this, but I think it's very important. A person has free will. That's axiomatic to Jewish thought, philosophy. In order to have free will, everything lofty I just said has to be a little bit like distant from normal people's consciousness. If the things I just said that were so obvious, they were so obvious, like, oh man, God, awesome. Present, awesome, so obvious. You might have technical free will, but a person would not have practical free will. Practically, we have free will because of the confusion of our lives. Because not everything is so super clear. So even though the greatest thing in the world is the only eternal reality of God, whatever, but if you say, I don't even know what he's talking about. Like, it's so, most of us are not so God's present. We're not. And that's okay. In fact, the Torah tells us we're not going to be that present. Because the Torah tells us, know today and place it into your heart. And if you're supposed to know today and place it into your heart, so the Musar masters teach that that means that there's something you can have in your head, but somehow it doesn't trickle down to your heart. Heart knowledge and head knowledge are not the same. The best example that I can think of heart knowledge is the danger of a red stove. The danger of a red stove nobody ever loses sight of. Nobody says, I forgot and I leaned on the stove. No, thank God. Nobody does that. Nobody says, I know it's wrong to lean on the stove, but if I lean on the stove, then I can have some candy, so I'm going to lean on the stove. Okay, if I lean on the stove, then I can hear like really good gossip about somebody. Nobody does that. So the difference between knowledge of God and knowledge of the danger of the red stove is the difference between something that's in our head and or versus in our head and our heart. Now, if that level of knowledge was in our heart all the time, there would be no free will. Does everybody get that idea? There'd be no free will, because if I said wrongdoing triggers bad news, God forbid, and it was evident every single second when there was wrongdoing, and it's not. So don't run away from here saying, oh my God, those people are crazy. Like, it's not like if I have an errant thought, like a desire for something wrong, then my left foot falls off. Okay? That's not going to happen. And that's okay. We don't want that to happen. For a lot of reasons. But it's also, there's free will, because the things I just spoke about, which are extremely lofty and high and wonderful, and like, I actually get present to that sometimes, but I think if somebody told that to me when I was 18, I would have said, I have no idea what the guy's talking about. So when you get present to that, it's not going to be that you will always be present to that. We're not all always present to that. We are not always, like, so excited to do the right thing. Sometimes, we're not excited to do the right thing. We want to... Everybody knows the concept of the evil inclination. There's inside of us, there's what we call the Yetzer Hara. It tells us to do the wrong things. So the evil inclination has a best friend. It has an invention that only belongs to the evil inclination. It's called the snooze bar. Okay? The snooze bar was created as the best buddy of the evil inclination. Because nobody ever hits the snooze bar because it was like a great decision. Okay? If you're like me, you're pre-programmed to make a bad decision. So you set your alarm for 5 minutes early so that you can have that delight of the one snooze bar. Okay? But the snooze bar comes from that place of, you're not always present. You just want to go to sleep. You want to be left alone. Right? One of the funniest proofs of the existence of the evil inclination is that we don't want to go to sleep at night as badly as we want to stay asleep in the morning. Okay? So if we were really like these awesomely calculated people, go, no, it's because I need 8 hours. So I go to sleep early. Okay? But it's not that way. It's, I just want to stay asleep. Leave me alone. Right? Or I have some desire for something delicious or whatever it may be. Delicious, that's not for me. It wasn't allotted to me. So whatever it may be, let's make sure this is still working. Yeah, it still is. Whatever it may be, we're not always present to that. But if we would be present to it, that's the highest form of connecting to God, and it's the highest form of connecting to others. Nobody wants to be in a relationship which is governed exclusively by commitment. The reason I can't come home every night, sweetheart, is because I promised you I would. That's not the highest form of affection in a family life. Right? I come home because I promised I would. No, I mean, you want to have a relationship where you come home because you want to, because everybody is excited to see each other. By the way, it doesn't always go that way. There are going to be nights that a person comes home because I promised I would. That's the other side of this thing. The other side of this thing is that a real relationship is not governed exclusively by the highest form of what it ought to be. It ought to be at the highest form. I want to. I need to. I can't imagine anything better. And yet we are not always present to that, and therefore a real relationship is governed by some measure of rules and regulations that I'm required to. Nobody ever wants, even if you have if you love your job, and I love my job, but even if you love your job, it is rare, very rare, that you meet somebody who every single day went to work because I love my job. Sometimes you go to work because you're supposed to, you have to, it's expected, you won't get your paycheck, you might get fired, you're going to ruin a relationship, they're counting on you. You see the reality of these things? One is love. It brings us close. The other one is commitment. It's responsibility. And I want to give one last example of this battle. So we all have, and I'm going to use an example from my own life, but the example I'm using is not exactly pertinent to all. I like telling this story. I teach in the Yeshiva High School once a week, and I recently told the boys that I teach this reality, and they all got it because they have the same kind of lifestyle choices as I do. So I'm committed to offering prayers 3 times a day. Okay? I daven every day, 3 times a day. that probably doesn't come as much as a surprise to the people present. You know. So some of you witness it. I'm almost always here 3 times a day. So on the occasion that I, for whatever reason, could not offer the prayers, Maariv evening prayers, with a minyan. Now this year, I'm in mourning for my father, Harini Kaparas Mishkovo, so that hasn't happened. But there are reasons why we all have schedule issues, so it happens sometimes that I don't offer prayers in the synagogue in the evening. So it also happens sometimes that I don't realize I didn't offer the prayers until I am already under my covers. Happens sometimes. Okay, you go to sleep, and you're about to go to sleep, and you say Shema, and you say, uh-oh, this sentence is not that familiar. I said it this morning at 6:45, and not this evening at 6:45. Trouble! So if you're committed, you get out of bed. You go daven. Because you have to. If that's what you've accepted upon yourself as your responsibilities. So you do it because you have to. I actually get really excited by that moment. Okay? Nobody really likes that moment, but I really like that moment. Okay, because when you realize that you already did what you had to do, it's in the past. So in the past, I said Shema, I said the 2 blessings before Shema, the 2 blessings after Shema, the 19 blessings of the Shemona Esrei, and Aleinu. I did that in the past. When you realize when you're on your bed, and it's 12:28, or 1:44, you know, and you say, and I don't go to sleep so late every night, believe you me, but let's just say, you realize, you get into bed, and you, I didn't daven. So now, actually, there's something awesome in front of you. The opportunity to accept upon yourself the sovereignty of the heavens. The opportunity to say, blessed are you. Now, in most societies, the use of the word you, historically and even today, is reserved only for close relationships. If you speak Spanish or know Spanish a little bit, you speak in usted form if you are not close to the person. If it's normal when you speak Yiddish to say not how are you, but how is this person? How is this Jew? And we speak in third person. Is it true in French also?
Tu and vous.
Tu and vous, right? Yeah. So you speak in third person when somebody deserves honor. So God allows us, instructs us to say, blessed are you, Ata. That's a privilege. We're not usually present to that, but that's a privilege. If you didn't yet say Maariv and you're on your bed, you have the opportunity to stand up and, by the way, get dressed in a suit and a tie. Tie your shoes. Or not. You could fulfill the obligation in your pajamas. I choose in that situation to get dressed in a suit and tie at 1:44. I hope it never happens again. I'm not happy about it. Okay? But in that scenario, you could stand up and say, blessed are you. 23 times. Great news. That's fantastic news. That's, hey, you want to be the bat boy tomorrow? Hey, you want to pick that person up from the airport? The writer? How about 1:44 a.m.? You want to pick him up from the airport?
Yes.
You probably would. You probably would. It wouldn't have been your favorite choice, but you probably would.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's what it looks like when we're governed by love. When love is first. When love is highest. We're not always there. So guess what happens when you don't want to put on the suit? And you don't want to say the 23 blessings to God. Okay? Then you do it anyway. Because you want to do the right thing. So because you made a commitment. Because you said, I will. So you do it anyway. Okay, so now. Any questions so far? I have so much more to say, and I see we're not going to get through everything I wanted to say, but any questions so far? Does anybody want to argue with me?
Not argue, but just
leave it. Gary, right?
Hey, Gary.
Okay.
Does he have kind of that usted in two form?
Very good question. Okay, excellent question. Does Hebrew have the usteda and two forms. So yet Hebrew has present and absent forms. Okay, what we call second person and third person. Like ata as opposed to who. Actually, every single time we say a blessing, shockingly, we say both. We move from one to the other. So for example, if I say about God that he brings everything into being, which is the blessing that we say when we're going to eat meat or drink any drink, almost any drink. The word bidvaro means in his word, through his word. Before it, I said, Baruch atah, blessed are you, in his word. Okay, that's weird, right? And you find in today, in the vernacular of the yeshiva world, students do not speak to teachers in second person. So somebody, Israeli fellow who wants to be nice to me when he comes in here, will say to me, looking at me, will say, Ich korim la rav. What is the rabbi's name? I'm standing right in front of him. He says, what is the rabbi's name? In our yeshiva, if you want to speak to one of your teachers, so you say, does Rebbe have time to meet with me today? Can I visit the Rosh Hashiva's house this afternoon? Speaking directly to the person. So in Yinglish, okay, we have it, and Hebrew we have it also. It's different than the usted form, because in the usted form there's a specific respectful second person, but it actually is the third person, right? It's the su instead of two form. It's just the third person. In Hebrew, you wouldn't call it that way, but it's the same. Okay? Sure. Any other questions so far? Please.
When do you feel that you're doing something out of love and Kiddush Hashem, or just because it's been so habitual that it becomes something that's such a habit that it could be like any other habit that you just have to do it, or you don't feel right that day? Like you don't go to the gym,
right?
You don't feel right the whole day.
Okay.
How do you know when?
So you know when because you know when. And it's a lifetime of a war. You got to fight that war every day. You know it because you know it. Right? In other words, I'll give you an example from me. I have one of my teachers I have tremendous reverence for. I am literally scared to talk to him. Literally. I ask myself why. I'm not afraid he's going to slap me. I'm not afraid he's going to hurt me. And I'm going to come to answer that question a little bit later. Okay? I'm going to answer that particular question a little bit later, because we've only talked about love so far. We haven't really gotten into the fear side at all. But I'm scared to talk to him. I cannot. It would not be possible for me to call that teacher while driving. It would be too distracting. I can't pick up the phone and call this Rebbe of mine. I am so calculated in every single word that I say to him. Really, it's, you know why? Really? It's because I love him. And I will hint to this now. Here's where the fear is. I'm afraid to lose him. Mm-hmm. That's really where the fear is. I'm afraid to lose him. I love him so much and I respect him so much that I'm totally shaken when I talk with him. I'm embarrassed to tell you, and this is being recorded, okay, but I'm embarrassed to tell you that I can easily say a blessing while driving. No problem. It doesn't make me shake. So here I'm talking to God. I'm all enraptured. This is Mr. You. This is Mr. Tyon. This is Mr. You know, loves to put on his tefillin. I'm all, you know, I just made this whole skit about how super lofty I am. I can say, blessed are you, God, King of the world, who makes the fruit of the tree. No problem. So that's a problem, right? I should have to park. I should have to, in this like psychologically, I should have to like pull over. I'm going to speak to God, but I don't have to. So I got to work on it. Right? So we all are doing battle in that realm, and. Don't give up on familiarity because it breeds that. Because in the long run, it's better to do the right thing, not as right as you can, than to say, oh, I'm not going to do the right thing, it's just so I can be really present. Because I'm going to address this. I'm going to address this in a second. I hope. I hope we'll get there. Jack, can you do me a favor and just tip down the air conditioning? I see we have to set it again. We did this last Wednesday also. Okay. So the other side. The other side is, and the fear of heaven should be upon you. What does that mean, the fear of heaven? So the Rambam, Maimonides, in the book of Mitzvot, this is not that work. He writes, he's the most daring writer in Jewish history. That's a guy you'd want to pick up in the airport. Okay? Most daring writer in Jewish history. You know why I say that? Because two things blow me away about Maimonides. Number one, he's not only the first person in the history of the Jewish people to organize Jewish law into an organized encyclopedia of all of Jewish law, because the Talmud is not organized. It's sort of a flow of consciousness conversation. And so the laws of one thing can be here and there and there and there. The Rambam was the first to bring it all together. He's not only the first, he's actually the only one in history. There never was another book written ever in Jewish history that's a complete encyclopedia of Jewish law. Because even the code of Jewish law, the Shulchan Aruch, and the Tur, which is the Shulchan Aruch is based on, they don't cover many areas of Jewish law that have to do with temple times. So the Rambam, Maimonides, is the only one to ever write a book on the complete volume of Jewish law. So much so that he has the temerity, awesome, to say, because he was right, that if you have the Bible and you have my 14-volume work, you have the whole Torah in your hands. Wow. Wow. Nobody's ever tried that since. That's one reason the Rambam is the most courageous writer in Jewish history. The second reason is because the Talmud tells us there are 613 commands, but it doesn't tell us what they all are. And if you open the Bible, the Chumash, the Torah, you'll find a lot of instructions. So you have to figure out which instruction is a command and which is not. So for example, leave Egypt tonight is not a command. Okay, that's not a command. But do not murder is a command. So you have to figure out which of these lines, and the Talmud tells us some of them, and the Talmud tells us that there are 365 negatives and 248 positives. So we've got some rules, but the Rambam and others who lived in his time figured out their understanding of which are the 613. But the Rambam's the only one who put them in order. Wow. That's a blowaway idea. And the Rambam writes his commands in the order that he sees them as foundational. So the first command, and the positive one, not surprisingly, is to believe that there's a God. The second command is to know that that God is a singular being. That's a topic for another time, what that means. The third command is to love God. The fourth command is to fear God. That's how fundamental what we're talking about tonight is. By the way, I think it's just an important idea. The fifth one is to pray. And the sixth one is to honor Torah scholars. Shocker, actually, that would be sixth. Really, I think that would surprise everybody. Like, we haven't even gotten to Shabbos yet. Okay? It's a fascinating idea. Now, be that as it may, listen to what the Rambam says about the mitzvah to love God. He says the third mitzvah is the mitzvah that we are commanded to love the lofty one. And that is that we should delve into and consider his commands and his actions until we grasp him and take pleasure in the grasp of him, the greatest pleasure possible. And that is love. So grasp will lead to love. We're going to come back to that idea. Fear is fourth. That is the command to believe in the reverence of God, yiraso, fear, reverence, whatever. And to be afraid, and not like the heretics who just go wantonly, who just go haphazardly, but be afraid of punishment. I didn't want to say it, but that's what it says. Nobody wants to talk about that. I have good news. It's not the only definition the Rambam gives to this mitzvah. Because if you open the book of Yesodei HaTorah, the opening of the Rambam's discussion about God. So he says that the first mitzvah is the belief that God exists. Then in the second chapter he says, there's a command to love and to fear God. As it says in the Torah, in the Shema, V'ahavta es Hashem Elokecha, you shall love Hashem your God. And it also says, es Hashem Elokecha tira, God you shall fear. Now, what I'm about to tell you is so spectacular that it would be wonderful if you knew it by heart. It would be even amazing if you were present to it all the time, but none of us is. What is the path to love and fear? Okay, now that's a great question. It's another way of saying, how can God legislate emotions? I don't love. I'm not afraid. I'm not moved. I'm not amazed. I'm not awestruck. So the Rambam is asking, how do you become awestruck and in love? He says, at the moment that a person contemplates God's actions, creations that are wondrous and gigantic, and sees through them his wisdom, that there is no end to it and no limit, he immediately loves and praises, extols, and has great desire to know God. As King David said in the book of Psalms, my soul is thirsty for God, the living God. So let's try to understand that. Did you know that the whole universe is in balance exactly due to the relative distance of the heavenly bodies and their relative mass? If the earth were larger, or Mars was larger, or the moon was larger, or smaller, or closer or further, the world could explode from any of those. I'm no great scientist, but I think what I just said is accurate. Did you know that two gametes meet to create a zygote in the act of procreation? That is one cell. And from that one cell, it multiplies over a 9-month period to become an infinite number of cells that are differentiated between kidney cells that clean the blood, brain cells that tell the kidney to clean the blood, and toenails. And that troublemaker gets out of the trap that he was in, and that his mother gets better. Holy smokes, that's just unbelievable. We could go on and on about this. If I would know the person who created the current jumbo jet, who can take people, hundreds of them, put them into that multi-ton metal thing and lift it up off the ground and fly it across the world, that would amaze me. I would say, like, you are the coolest guy I ever met. That's unbelievable that you can do that. Ain't nothing compared to what God is capable of. Not capable of. We see it all the time. By the way, the majority of you were at the presentation last Wednesday night. Can you breathe from the story of Jewish history?
No.
Can you breathe from a group of people being told that they're going to be small in number, hated and dispersed and conquered, but they'll be forever, and then it goes that way, violating all of the rules? I can't breathe from that. That's like that, by the way, is my personal bedrock. I cannot breathe from that. So the moment that you have that, just like you're immediately moved to have a desire to be close to the author, close to the athlete, close to the Torah scholar, close to the loved one, you're moved by their greatness to be close to them. You want to be close. You want to be close. You desperately want the opportunity to be that driver. Just like you want that, one if one would be present to these things and contemplate these things, one would immediately be propelled to be close to God. What's the path to close? Okay, that's a little hard to keep, but it's well delineated in Jewish law, right? It's a little hard to keep. But one would want that. One would want that if one would be contemplative about God's greatness. Continues Maimonides. And when a person thinks about those very same things, uchshemechashev b'dvarim ha'ilu atzman, miyad, immediately, hu nirta l'achorav, he is shoved backwards. And is scared, fearful, and knows how small he personally is. Dark, simplistic, standing with a meager grasp in front of the one who is all grasping. Like King David said, when I see your heavens, I wonder who is man that you should even mention him. Yiras Shamayim, the fear of heaven, is on the one hand fear of punishment. And every relationship is governed by rules and commitments. But the highest form of that is not about punishment at all. It's actually about awe and amazement and sense of smallness. Some of you have heard me talk about forever. Forever can be imagined as the Pacific Ocean empty of water, filled instead with sesame seeds. And every 100 years a bird comes and takes one sesame seed. How long would it take to empty the Pacific Ocean of sesame seeds? If a bird took one sesame seed per century, and you will not yet have approached forever. So you think about how small you are. Now, you must be significant, otherwise this awesome being who has this whole divine plan would have no purpose for you here if you weren't spectacular and consequential and important. But you're also, all of us, a passing shade. No matter how bad they mourn for us after 120, so rare is the person who is mourned for 40 years later. So rare is the person who's even been heard of 40 years after they're gone, that if you think about the number of people you could name who lived in the 1800s, and that we could all name, and you compared that to the population of the world during the 1800s, it's so infinitesimally small that you realize that on the one hand I'm consequential. Talk about complementary opposites. On the one hand I'm consequential. On the other hand, I'm here today, gone tomorrow. And many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the idea that I think was from the Musar school of Kelm. That in one pocket, you're supposed to hold a piece of paper that says, for me the whole world was created. And in the other pocket, a piece of paper that says, I am but dust and ash. Complementary opposites. So we are thrust into a not a simplistic reality. A complicated reality of significance, of yearning and closeness, but also confusion and distance, of a desire like a fire to get close to it, and yet a desire like a fire to not get too close to it. And we're thrust in, but we have to act with reverence. The highest form of service of God is with love. The highest form of service of a spouse is with love. And yet, a love that would be undisciplined is lacking something so fundamental that it can be totally lost. I think of the person who runs into any shul out of their great love for God, opens up the ark, wraps himself up in the Sefer Torah, and starts dancing around. Irreverent, undisciplined, inappropriate, filled with love, but not a balanced love. It's not your best friend. The Talmud says that you're supposed to repeat the first sentence of the Shema if you didn't think of God when you said it. And then it says, but if you say it twice, then you sound like somebody who's talking to two different gods. Okay? So then it resolves the conflict and says, if you say each and every word, one after the other twice, Shema, Shema, Yisrael, Yisrael, then you sound like you're accepting two gods. But if you made a mistake the first time, and you weren't paying attention, then you should say it the second time and pay attention. Another opinion in the Talmud says, unbelievable words. Chavrusa klape shmaya? What are you, best friends with God? What do you mean? You have such a relationship with God that you said it irreverently the first time? You can't just walk around with God, just toss around with the hip. Hey God, I'm here. I had a friend, he led the prayer during basketball games, before games. He would start the prayer going, yo God, it's me, Norm. Okay? So it's cute if you're 17. You know what I mean? But like, there's a lot in the balance. There's like generations and the pleasures of my family and my sustenance and the world and peace and the Jewish people in Israel and there's, this is not simple stuff. At the same time, don't be afraid. In other words, don't say, because I need to be close to that fire. Well, being close to the fire is a little bit, you know, edgy, but over here it's freezing cold. So the balancing act is close and far. The balancing act is nearness and yet not irreverence. The highest form is love. But you can't live, no loving relationship, as we started from the four, no loving relationship is the love is so good, but the discipline is so bad. That's good. That's not good. You cannot have a real relationship in which it's all about love. And by the way, spirituality that is dependent on love, we say, there are no rules. Just come when you feel like it. So first of all, by the way, men will almost never come. Okay? And that's why all forms of religion that have no rules are seldom attended by men. That's not just a Jewish problem. It is a major Jewish problem, by the way, but it's not just a Jewish problem. Because guys are like busy watching sports, you know, like or whatever. And that would be me too. In other words, so we have this sense that we ought to be behaving out of commitment, but the highest form of behaving is out of emotions. When I don't have those emotions, the commitment has to kick in. When I have those emotions, the commitment is weak and small. It's like not important. So, because I have those emotions. But if I'm sitting in my bed and I don't want to get up to say Maariv, get up anyway, Charlie. Get up. Let's go. Got to make it happen. You got to go. You got to do the right thing. So that's this interplay. Now, I want to just share one more idea. By the way, you know God is compared to our Father, and God is compared to our King, Avinu Malkeinu. You see how that's in play here? The Avinu is the love side, the Malkeinu is the fear side. We are God's children, Banim Atem L'Hashem Malkeichem, you are God's children. And yet, Avodaihem, they are my servants. Same idea? Both are in play, all the time. So, last idea. When Joseph was in Egypt, Yosef, and now his whole family came down, his father is going to die, his father blesses his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Very famous biblical scene of Jacob crossing his hands and putting the primary hand on the younger son and the secondary hand on the older son. We spoke about this actually at length on Hanukkah, for those who attended the talk on Hanukkah about Hallel of the Exiles. And if you didn't, it's I can send you a link to it. It's recorded online. And so we're not going to spend an hour on this right now. We're just going to spend a couple of minutes on this. What was the argument between Yaakov and Yosef? What were they disagreeing about? The Torah records that Yosef said to Yaakov, Dad, don't cross your hands. This one's the older one. This one's the younger one. And Yaakov insisted. So, Menashe, the older son, his name, the Torah tells us, he's called Menashe because Joseph was giving praise to God for removing the negativity in his life. Ki nashani Elokim es kol amaliv es kol beis avi. That God made me forget my toil and the troubles of my father's house. That's Menashe's name. Ephraim's name is because God made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. Ki hifrani Elokim be'eretz onyi. Ephraim's name is fruitful. Menashe's name is forgetful of the bad stuff. Joseph was saying, by naming his first son, forgetful of the bad stuff, getting away from the bad stuff, Joseph was saying, here I am in Egypt, and the number one relationship I have to have with God is fear of falling apart. That's what everybody raises their kids in the exile, and they say, kid, I got to send you to that school or whatever it may be, but you know what? Don't do the wrong thing. Don't do the wrong thing. Stay strong. Joseph was saying that in naming for him family, I live here in Egypt, and I don't want my son to fall apart. I don't want my life to fall apart. So he's naming him in honor of the concept. Conceptually, he's calling him, don't do bad stuff. That's it. That's Menashe's name. Ephraim's name means made me fruitful, successful. That's not the removal of bad. That's the presence of good. Ephraim was called, made me successful in this land. Ki hifrani Elokim. It comes from the same word as pri, as fruit, and as pru or avu, be fruitful and multiply. That's Ephraim's name. So Joseph was saying, first comes the fear of heaven. Don't do the bad stuff. Second will come the love. By the way, we say this every morning. In the prayer service, we're supposed to say, Reshis Chachma Yiras Hashem, the beginning of wisdom is the fear of heaven. Don't do the bad stuff. And every parent says that to their kid, really. If you have to send your kid to a school you wish you didn't have to send them to, for whatever reason, you say to your kid, don't do the bad stuff. Just stay away from bad people. That's the way we think of it. Stay away from bad people. So we're supposed to stay away from the bad. That sort of comes from the fear side. I don't want to do the wrong thing. That's me not being able to talk to my teacher on the phone. I don't want to say the wrong thing. Scared. Fearful. That's what that looks like. That's what Joseph called his son living in Egypt. First one. Once you have that bedrock of strength, of character, of not doing the wrong thing, that's when you can be more emotional, more free to then serve out of love and emotionality. On the bedrock of commitment, of doing what's right, of not doing what's wrong. So he named his children in that order. Yaakov said, doesn't have to be that order. Even in the exile, if life is filled with proper stimulation of holy things, good things, and that was Yaakov's element, because Yaakov was a great studier of the Torah. So Yaakov was saying to his son, this one can be primary too. This one, Ephraim, which means to go and do good, can be primary. This one is secondary. And I want to tell you today, just take the one topic of technology. Technology is a great danger, not only to children, even to adults. Technology and the technological advances and the free access to inappropriate things or just wasteful time, it's a danger. I'm not here to tell you it's no good. I know you'll fight back with me, but it also is good. I already know it also is good. We agree. But it represents a danger, right? If you got a son who's 13, right, so it represents a danger. I rest my case. Case closed on that one for me, for my person. Okay. Now, if that war is fought exclusively with don't do the wrong thing. Don't do the wrong thing. You'll be punished if you do the wrong thing. I think it's a losing battle. I think that the Torah sources tell us that you have to have awesome stimulation in your life that makes you not want to have wasteful or sinful or bad stimulation. If somebody has lots of love in their life, if somebody has lots of exuberance and enthusiasm in their life. So we're all seeking stimulation, everybody. One of the ways to make sure that we don't go to the bad stimulation is the fear. I don't want to get caught. I don't want to do the wrong thing. So I look both ways and make sure no one's watching. That's one of the things. It's very important. It's called good defense. But there's also an offense to play with enthusiasm and exuberance for good things. A person needs stimulation. That's a basic human need. The Rebbe of P.S. Etzner writes in his diary that a person would rather see a train crash than see nothing. Because people need stimulation. We don't need to see... You know why we don't want to see a train crash? Because we watch it in the movies. Okay? So we don't need to see it in real life. But the P.S. Etzner Rebbe, he didn't see any movies. So he said, I'd rather see a train crash. Because we just don't want to be bored. Right, the proof that we don't want to be bored is that we turn the radio on when we get in the car. Right, often. Right to the button. So we need stimulation. Everybody needs stimulation. What Yaakov was saying to Yosef was, yes, you have to fight with fear. But you also have to fight with love. You also have to fight with filling the lives of children and adults with stimulating things. Because I can tell you personally, the more stimulation you have from important and good things... I'm just telling you, you just have less desire for things that are a waste of your time. Somehow or another, you're no longer that interested in what's happening with people you don't know to read about them on the gossip stuff, right? Somehow or another, you're just less interested in things that, like, you had a very stimulating day. A person has a very stimulating day, even in dieting. Like, you don't have to have the ice cream at night if you had a very stimulating day. You're not looking for something for stimulation. So that is what Yaakov and Yosef are talking about. In the exile, there's a fear element. I don't want to do the wrong thing. But there's also a love. Fill the plate with good stuff that makes a person not need to run after the bad stuff. So now, I know I said a lot of stuff tonight. Okay? Let's make it an ongoing conversation, because what really everything I said tonight is to illustrate the point of these... of this battle we have in our lives of close and far, of emotionality and discipline, of stimulation and restraint. And I can tell you that we, even if you're really, really present to this stuff, we do battle with this every day about how to turn it into simple instructions for life. Okay? But the simple instructions... let's make that part of the ongoing conversation, is how do we adopt disciplines or accountability or things that give structure? How do we adopt, how do we access exuberance and enthusiasm? And how do we become the best people in our life? Because really everything I said, although I mentioned God a lot of times, is super transferable to every part of our lives. It's really super transferable to relationships, to work, to think. It's just discipline and passion. Passion and discipline. Passion and disciplines can be enemies, because passion by its nature is slightly undisciplined. Discipline at its nature is totally dispassionate. And yet the magic is made in the marriage and the overlap of passion and discipline. Okay, we'll stop now.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.